So, good morning, everybody. My name's John Sheridan. I'm going to be chairing this session this morning and helping the speakers divide the time equally between them. So, first up is Rain.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. It's really great to be at OpenTech again. My name is Rain Ashford. I'm Rain Chat on Twitter. I'm going to speak about my work, my research in wearable tech. So it's 6 years now since I last spoke at OpenTech, and I spoke about my work, which was in wearable tech, that was using a lily pad. And the lily pad Arduino, as you probably know, is an open source wearable piece of equipment which has lots of sewable inputs and outputs, which you can connect sensors and actuators with conductive thread. I used this in all my first pieces of work, which were based around wearables for sound, for sensing, for gaming. And these are a few examples of what I spoke about at the last OpenTech. I was particularly interested in social interaction, and I'm still really interested in social interaction, and that's the path I've taken with my wearables in the last 6 years. This is my first piece of emotive wearables, as I call them, and this is a temperature sensing t-shirt. So basically, I find some social situations quite difficult when engaging how people feel. So I made this t-shirt that would light up if my temperature went over a certain Celsius temperature. So basically there's a temperature sensor here, and you've got two faces. The first one here is like a happy, calm and collected green face, and if my temperature was below a certain Celsius, it would stay lit up with the eyes on that one. And if I got like hot and flustered, like if someone was in my face, the premise would be it would light up the eyes on the red kind of flustered face. And this is my first foray into emotive wearable tech, and I found this area really fascinating. And so the second piece, that another piece that I showed at OpenTech last time, and I actually wore it, is this what I called a techless. Basically, I was wearing a band that was monitoring my heart rate, and this heart spot was actually made by Eric Boyd, but he kindly allowed me to hack the code and the hardware to add a proximity sensor, so that when somebody came into my proximity at about 80 centimetres, which is in line with Edward Hall, if you know Edward Hall, who philosophised about social spaces, if someone came within this radius, it would light up and it would start blinking my heart rate. You can make of what you will of the actual kind of heart rate, the different beats per minute, but supposedly 70 beats per minute is like all calm and collected. When I wore this at the last OpenTech, I put it on a face mode, so I actually appeared cool, calm and collected. So I'm actually really interested in what we can do if we start to manipulate what we project in terms of our like physiological data, like heart rate, gait, etc., and how we appear to others. So I wore this at the last OpenTech, and I don't know if I got away with it, but I hoped that people thought I was cool, calm and collected. I was okay, but it was funny to speak to people afterwards. So 6 years later, from the first OpenTech, still making physiological data-driven pieces. This piece is actually pairing physiological data with environmental data, because I'm really interested in what happens, as I said, in not only social situations, but environments too. So this piece is the barometric skirt, and it has a barometric sensor in it, which monitors, again, Celsius, the ambient Celsius, meters, as in height, which is like, say, when you're like moving around a space, it measures like the height. So in a place like this, I'm on the third floor, so it would be like several meters, and basically it lights up based on my physiological temperature and also the surrounding temperatures and height, etc. So this piece, because I was really interested in what happens when you start to mix up your personal data, I went on to focus on EEG data, basically because I then wanted to kind of find out what kind of signals we're giving out to people when we're standing in front of them talking, but what are we really thinking? Taking the analogy of wearing your heart on your sleeve, how does your data betray you from what you're actually thinking? So in 2012, I started making this, the EEG visualizing pendant. And basically, it was using an EEG headset, which was sending via Bluetooth two streams of data, one ascribed to attention and the other ascribed to relaxation. So what the piece does is via a 8x8 LED matrix, it shows the data moving up and down. So in the code, so to try and explain it, so if you've got 0 to 100, I've divided the signal up between, so take, for example, attention, so not paying attention, paying a bit more attention, elevated, very attentive. So, for example, if you're speaking to somebody in a social situation, say today downstairs in the bar, and I was wearing this piece, you might be able to, if you knew the person, you might be able to start to discern whether they're paying attention to you or not, or if, for example, if you were looking at the other stream, whether or not they were relaxed in your company. So what it does, it cycles through three different ways of presenting it. So rectangles, diagonals, and circles. So I'm also looking at the aesthetics of wearables and how we present ourselves and how we present our data. I would show you a video, but I can't quite get it to... it might show you now. So this is me wearing the pendant. I'm afraid I model all my pieces and film my video. So you can see the green is the meditation or relaxed data, and the red is the concentration or paying attention data. And what I did with this piece is I did some research with various groups of people. So I took it to the Quantified Self conference in Amsterdam and tested it with a group of so-called experts who were very used to wearing wearable tech and being monitored, etc. I tested it with three different groups of women in different age ranges, because I'm really interested in what women think about technology and the design and what they would wear. And I took it to a maker fair, and I also did field trials with people wearing it to work, when they're teaching, when they're having dinner with their mum, when they're out partying. And I asked a number of questions. I asked, for example, I asked a load of questions, actually, but I wanted to find out who the potential users of this technology, if people were to take it up, if people were to think that they might wear their heart on their sleeve full time, if they would be happy to wear a piece of wearable tech that projects and visualises and amplifies how they feel. So I asked people about this. I asked them what their concerns were, I asked what their aesthetic requirements were, and their user experience requirements. And from that, I made two new pieces of wearable tech as an iteration from the pendant. The first piece, which I've got with me today, I won't get it out because it takes too long to put together, but if you want to see it in the bar later, is this piece, an enemy star heart. You can meditate with it if you're wearing the headset. I designed it for a group of women who said they didn't want to wear their heart on their sleeve out in public, but they were really happy to share their data with their loved ones, and they also wanted something that akin to mood lighting. So this piece is a pendant, and you can put it in a room, and it will light up the room for you with your EEG data. The second piece that I made from my research is this Thinkabell dress, which takes the two streams of data again, the red, the attention, green, meditation, and it's a fiber-optic dress, and I paid attention to a group of women who were 18 to 24 who said, yeah, I'd quite like to amplify my data, but I'd like to wear something that I can wear clubbing when non-verbal communication comes into its own, where, for example, you're in a noisy club or a bar and you're dancing and you can show how you're feeling to your friends without kind of shouting across the room, and also how your friends can see how you're feeling from like a distance. I have a video of this, but I'm not sure that I have time to show that. Got a really rubbishy interface on here, so I didn't mean to do that. So just to show you the conclusion, I have 3 minutes. So there's the dress. Sorry, I managed to get it in the end. The dress, because I'm interested in aesthetics and the bespoke and personalisation, the fibre optic is movable around the body, so you can Velcro where you position the fibre optics. And also with all my pieces with EEG, they've all got record and playback. So if you want to appear a certain way, or you want to seem more attentive, you can record lots of attention data. If you want to seem really relaxed, you can record lots of meditation or relaxed data. So to finish up very quickly, in summary, these are a few tiny, I've got like 8 hours, so I've got tons and tons of interviews, but just to finish up quickly with a few points about my research. So who are the potential users who are interested in this stuff? The potential users are interested in finding out more about themselves. They're interested in what makes them stressed or what makes them relaxed. They're interested in communicating with their friends and family. They're interested in what this kind of wearable could mean to them when they project themselves in public and in private. So how do people feel about wearing these devices? Both excitement at the attention that it gives, and also self-conscious about wearing it. So there's a fine line between like geeky and like looking nerdy and looking like how you want to present yourself. What concerns do people have? So unsurprisingly, privacy, security, where does my data go, who has my data, and who gets the data, and what happens if someone has my data and they sell it to someone else. In terms of aesthetic requirements, people are interested in the bespoke, how wearable pieces look on them, And they're interested in ultra personalisation, so where on the body it goes. So a lot of people like want to actually, rather than like project out this data, they want to see it. So they'd like it on their sleeve here, so they can do that and see how they're feeling. Size, more, less LED. Some people like loads of LEDs, some don't, unsurprisingly. And the functionality. So people came up with different modes they'd like. Modes for showing their data in front of different people. So, for example, a teacher at Quantified Self said, I don't want my students to see when I'm like not paying attention to them. Can you just make it so they only see like positive data? Usable in different environments, alerts for signalling, uncomfortable situations. So going back to the girls in the clubs, like, can you show my friend when I'm being hit on and I don't like it? Anyway, so I'm being nodded at by John. That was a really quick whirlwind of the last 6 years of my work in wearable tech. Done.
That's brilliant. Thank you.
That's really fascinating. I'm going to hand on to Jacob, who's going to talk to us about local democracy needs public data mapping.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Just get this hooked in. And there we go. Good morning, thank you very much for coming here. My name is Jacob Karib. On a day-to-day basis, I'm an integration and messaging consultant. I'm also an author. I wrote a couple of books. I do conference presentations, that sort of thing. And I'm an accidental local activist. Today's presentation is about saving Hannam Library, using open data, publicly accessible data for local democracy purposes. So where exactly is Hannam? Which is an excellent, excellent question you might be asking. Hannam is a suburb of Bristol, so any other Bristolians in the crowd? We're not actually in Bristol, though. We're in the Ring Road, but we're part of South Gloss County, South Gloucestershire. It's an interesting county. It's completely opposite of Bristol, even though we're across a roundabout. Our political dynamic is three levels of government now, four, all conservative. We have parish council, county council, West of England mayor, central government. And what these, what each level of government does is, because it's all the one party, it does tend to kind of to implement the policies of the level above it, which is extremely frustrating from our ends. But it's not a political monoculture as you might think. So, as you all know, we've been going through a period of budget tightening, or cuts, as the rest of us call it. And since 2010, the South Gloss budget has changed in 2015 by $45 million per annum. By 2020, that'll be down by $70 million per annum, which is a sum total of about 30% in cuts. Now, why is it 30% in cuts? Well, the reason is because local government actually gets most of its funding from central government, and central government just keeps cutting the amount of money that it gives to local government to provide services, where actually most of the services get provided. So, with cuts of this depth, you'd pretty much expect that all services are going to be affected, and libraries are absolutely not going to miss out on that. So, South Gloucestershire's Budget Council put forward a goal that in 2016-2017, they were going to save themselves $650,000 off the library budget per annum. So $650,000 in cuts is quite a lot over 11 libraries. So they put forward this library consultation about, okay, what we'd like to do is, here's a bunch of options, here's the situation, here's a bunch of libraries and how it's going to affect you, sort of, more or less, but in kind of a nice, hidden away sort of way. You can hide a lot of stuff in public. So they proposed three options. Firstly, close some libraries, cut the rest by 20%, and use volunteers for what has formerly been paid jobs. Now that would save 500,000, it's slightly unethical because you're actually asking people to take on work that other people have previously been getting paid for. So this was never actually going to get put through. The second one was a hub-and-spoke model where certain libraries were going to keep their status. They'd also start delivering some other local council services, but the rest of the libraries would get cut down to 2 days a week. This is problematic. It gets to 650,000, but it's very problematic. Why? Because libraries aren't actually about books. They've changed over time to provide services for the elderly, people with learning difficulties, the unemployed for building CVs, mother and baby groups, school visits, all of these sorts of things. So if you cut it by, cut down to 2 days a week, that's going to be a serious impact on the community. The third one was keep five only, close the rest, save a million, money in our pocket for the next round of cuts. So these were the libraries as were laid out. The red ones were the ones that they planned to keep at all costs. Okay, mostly it's a geographical distribution to do a fair distribution geographically. But most of the people actually live within the ring road of Bristol or just underneath the M4 here. These two libraries over here are in the constituency of the head of the council, and they're pretty much across the roundabout from each other, so they were obviously going to get kept. That's a lot of people here to be missing out on public services. So a group of angry parents spontaneously erupted. So we formed this group, Save Hanham Library. Now, what exactly did we want to achieve? Well, firstly, to keep all the libraries open. Once one's gone, you're not going to reopen it. It took 30 years to get a library in Hanham. We weren't going to give it up very easily. So our first principle, we didn't want to disadvantage other areas. We wanted more money from the council. We wanted them to cancel rebates that they had promised for optional services. Strangely enough, they have had a green bin collection that was costing, £5 a year to the average household. But if the local council didn't give that back, that'd be $200,000 that they had to spend on something else. The other thing was to actually dip into reserves. Now the council has $100 million of reserves. That might seem a lot, but actually the budgets are much larger than that on an annual basis. The other one was to pick up additional funding from parish councils. Parish councils operate over neighbourhoods. They have the option of raising something called a precept, which is a local tax. So what did we do? Well, we basically wallpapered the place. We stuck pamphlets in every house in the area. We wrote petitions to the council. We did protests, participating in the actual consultations, speaking to the media, and speaking to county and parish councils. Now, this is a really, really difficult thing to do, because when you're talking to a council, they have limited attention, because you are in a three-hour council meeting, which is held about once a month. You are right between, cleaning up dog waste and grass cuttings, so you have to hit them hard with relevant information very, very quickly. So we needed charts. Where were the users coming from? How would the parishes be affected? Were there any usage trends? And in order to do that, we needed data. So I put in a Freedom of Information request, thinking, okay, well, this is the sort of information that I want to do. I'll work out how to actually present it later. So I said, right, please, for every single time a book was borrowed over the last 12 months, give me the timestamp, the borrower postcode, and the library. This was very critical to make sure that we couldn't get any user identifiable data, because otherwise they would have rejected the Freedom of Information request. So a postcode goes over about 25 to 30 houses. So we're able to get a kind of a fairly good finger in the air that this is where people are coming from. All government systems have historical data. You can get your hands on it if you know what to ask for and you ask nicely. So once you've got this data, you can actually ask some really, really interesting questions, and questions naturally emerge. Like, which parishes are using each library most? How many users of one library use others? All these sorts of kind of interesting things, as long as you know how to analyze it. So we had the postcodes, we had the library information, we had to find out where exactly they were geospatially, GPS coordinates, so that we can actually find distances and ranges. I found a website called ukpostcodes.com, which actually takes it from the Ordnance Survey, which has some web services on it that you can call, and it gives you GPS coordinates, council, which parish, which constituency, etc. So I had a massive CSV document with 1.2 million records. I had this thing which actually had the GPS data, and the actual thing that I was going to do to calculate all of this stuff was using something called PostGIS. It's a geographical information system. It's an addition to the Postgres database. And the overall architecture of it was take the CSV, run an import script into it, put it into a staging database in Postgres, clean up the data, because it's a government system, there's dirty data, run a loading script, stick it onto a queue. Why can't I just run a script to call a web service? Well, there's 1.2 million records in there. That narrows down to, say, 10,000 postcodes. 10,000 hits against the web service, you're going to get throttled, you're going to get banned. So I had to basically throttle it in some way, make sure that I can resume the job, all of this sort of stuff. So I wrote a little process, a location data import with a tool called Apache Camel. It's awesome for doing integration. I wrote a book on it. You'll love it. The tool, not the book. The book is all right. Christmas is coming. Get one for your friends. Load it into PostGIS. And then I wrote a web app. I'm not a JavaScript guy. I don't do front ends. I managed to hack something together. It's possible, right? So there's a graphing library, Google Maps, web app written in Spring Boot, all of it running on Amazon Web Services, 30 quid a month. Okay? So once that was done, we were able to build these sorts of cool maps, right? Radius charts around where exactly the users are around libraries. Each ring here represents 10% of the users of the library. And we found that 50% of the users of the library were actually within a very, very small area, which isn't particularly surprising. Each ring gets a little bit wider, it covers a larger surface area once you work out that the radius, the space, gets bigger. And you can see this through the when we actually chart the postcodes that we're using the library. Interestingly enough, the house address of the councillors that were responsible for these budgetary cuts wasn't actually in this data, strangely enough. And what we worked out was that the further you go from a library, the less likely you are to use it. So these are hyper-local services, right? So one of the things we hit when we started talking to parish councils was, yeah, but we're Hannam Abbots, we're not Hannam, that's Hannam Library. Our users don't really use it. You're like, no, well, hang on a second. No, that's nonsense. This is all of the users of Hannam Parish. That's the concentric circles of Hannam Library. You'll find that all of them fit within the 50% ring of that, and they're probably not likely to go to the other libraries. Data in action. Once you've got this, you can say, okay, your parish also uses our library 93.7% of the time, not the other stuff. This is big impact stuff. It's so much more useful than actually doing charts. When we were talking to the consultation people, we actually started using the time series data. When exactly were these things being used? And what we found was the same sorts of patterns. That most of the time, they kind of tend to get used. You can see that on 2 days they're closed, except for certain occasions. There's a peak during summer holidays. And during the week, this is kind of what these things look like. So we were able to do this for all 11 libraries. So what was the outcome? The council made the cuts. Because of course they did. But all the libraries are still open. Yay! Right? We close it, it all goes wrong. Hannam Library got the largest cuts. Why? As a thank you note. Right? It's like, screw you. Parish councils did not help. We were hoping for a precept. They said no. But we want a lot of friends for the next round. There will be next rounds. There will be more council cuts. Lessons learned. Awesome. Lessons learned. You can't convince people who don't want to be convinced. Absolutely. Data and views are the starting point for a conversation. Not necessarily with the people you would think. This, as it turns out, it wasn't actually the councils that we should have been talking to. It was our friends, it was our neighbours, it was the people in our schools, it was the people who were actually at the library. And data must support an in-person campaign. In-person campaigns, take this data, give it to other people, share it as widely as possible, let them build up their own pamphlets, build up their own flyers, build up their own banners, get them involved in doing stuff. People want to get active. So here's another campaign I've gotten involved in, fairer funding for all schools, $3 billion in cuts coming over the next 3 years, 99% of all secondary and primary schools are going to be affected. We're getting all the data off this website that did something very similar called schoolcuts.org.uk. They allow you to search by school postcode or place. This is my daughter's school over here. Make the data interpretable, right? It's one thing to say that a school is losing £75,000 a year. It is a completely different thing to say that it's going to have two less teachers. People get angry about this sort of thing. The best thing that these guys actually did was that they made the data available in spreadsheet format. All of the various views, all the questions that we asked, they presented as spreadsheets. So you could actually get in contact with them. They'd give you access to their Dropbox account. You can download this information. We built our own banners. We wrote, we've got our flyers. We're distributing them to, at the moment, 10,000 houses in our local constituency. People want to get involved. People want to be civically active. And I urge you to do the same thing as well. Finally, be persistent. Be persistent. The odds are against you. There are people who can get their agenda through without doing anything. Your job is to get them to do something. This is a very, very difficult thing. It is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And you need to keep fuel in the tank. And the best way to do that is to engage other people. And that's the way to do it. Thank you very much. My name is Jacob Carr, and I finished on time. Woo!
So, next up is Ranika, who's going to talk about leaseholds. So, do you need a computer?
Hey! Hi. If I sit down, can you see me? Okay. Hi. So basically, I'm just here to talk about the housing issue, which is leasehold, which there are around 4 to 5 million leaseholds in the country, and it's a form of tenure that is rapidly rising and is disproportionately affects the young. And basically, what's happening is that many of these properties are turning into toxic assets. And we have a situation where I don't know if many of you are aware of the campaigns and things around. I fell into this because I've got a leasehold flat and I could not believe the stuff that I was dealing with. And when I went into it and then I started getting onto Twitter, which was a godsend because I was having a nervous breakdown, suddenly I found that there was this whole underworld, this whole subculture, which everybody is acting in isolation in. So it's very hard to come together on leasehold matters. And they're all fighting the same thing over and over. A quarter of leasehold homes have got leases under 80 years, which is going to cost about $4 billion to extend. Nationwide, last week, basically turned around and said that they were not going to lend on leasehold properties, and it was launching a new valuation policy because of all the onerous leasehold terms. And this has essentially rendered many, thousands of properties unsellable. And they're doing this because they're the first lender to impose fairer and more transparent lending conditions on these homes. And they're suggesting that that charges on this should not amount to more than 0.1%, which is not the case. Now, what many people don't realise is that leasehold was created as a money-making mechanism for freeholders at the expense of leaseholders. So in addition to paying for service charges, there are four main areas where freeholders just gobble it all up. And the weird thing is that when we went in to check out who the freeholders were and where they were ending up, people would buy a home, they would be told you can buy your freehold in a couple of years for £6,000. It suddenly jumped to £45,000, £90,000, and your freeholder has changed. And we found that there was a connection with offshore trusts and freeholders. So a lot of freeholders, for some reason, that they've got things going on in the British Virgin Islands. One person that we were trying to track down what the hell he was doing with the freeholds of these properties had 46,000 companies registered to him in British Virgin Islands. We couldn't cope with that. So the crazy thing about a leasehold home, you'll see it everywhere, all these flats, all the flats down the Thames River, you've got leasehold houses, for some reason loads of them being sold in the north, in Barnsley, Burnham, these places. They have this weird clause in them called a forfeiture. And it means, I mean, I did a documentary on this. I was going to show it to you, but it would have taken up 8 of the minutes here, so I didn't. And it's on the internet, you can find it. And so as a freeholder, your rights are unassailable, and they're considered covenants. As a leaseholder, your rights are not unassailable because they're carved out of freehold. They're just a sort of subset, which is all based on reasonableness. And when you go to law, or anywhere basically, you find that the reasonableness is always stacked in the freeholder's terms. And the people deciding this are the only ones with the access to data and information. Freeholders have got no access to information. They don't know. There was a chap called Chris, somebody or other, he is at LSE. He drilled down into his data. He's a professor on the Competition Markets Authorities, and he found out that the managing agents, who were Foxtons, were charging him £600 to change a light bulb. So he managed to get together a class action, because he was a lawyer by profession, and he's suing them for £42 million. But the point is that anybody who's got a leasehold flat, you're going to find yourself with this stuff going on, and you cannot drill down into the data. You cannot compare your flat to the next person's building down the road. You can't compare it to another one in another area. You can't compare when you try to buy your freehold. You cannot compare the prices that they're being sold for. So, for instance, we find that someone who's the troublemaker on an estate trying to buy their freehold, they might come to them and say, well, we'll make you a special offer just to get rid of them because they're a rabble-rouser and an activist, and everybody else is paying £45,000, that person is offered a special deal. The same thing is happening with service charges. And this is happening not just in the private sector, it's happening in the state sector too. Leasehold flats are a nightmare, absolute nightmare. You have even less rights than a private leaseholder. And you'll find things like the council are basically turning around and saying, you're the activist, you're the troublemaker, we'll offer you a deal on this, the rest of you will pay this kind of stuff. And I've got stories coming out of my ears on that. Now, the strange thing about leasehold is this forfeiture clause. So you have a bill that comes to you from your freeholder or your managing agent, and they're overcharging you year by year. And they can make estimates. And because they use this word, it's a reasonable estimate, they can take a job that should cost £10,000, they can take it to £100,000. And there are so many tricks on this as to how to do it. You overspec the job, you knock out smaller contractors, you put VAT, you've got backhanders, and it goes on and on and on. But the thing is that if you then go to the tribunals, Leasehold Valuation Tribunal, now called the First Tier Property Chamber, it's a star chamber. It's just a jobs club for people in the industry. They all know each other. They all kind of get jobs from each other. And you're supposed to go in as a layperson and represent yourself in what is meant to be, was set up as a low-cost tribunal. You find that all the data on this, which should be public data, it's unusable. You can't cross-reference anything. They've got all the tribunal decisions there, and you, as a person going in, are just at the whim of that one tribunal. Do not take what happens elsewhere as any kind of precedent for what's going to happen with you. And as people have found out, you go there, you're being overcharged, even if you're found, if you can prove it with all the tricks that the freeholders and managing agents will play against you, If you can find that you've been overcharged, you'll then be hit with something like 50,000 to 100,000 lawyer's fees. You'll find that what happens then is you can be taken very easily. It's not a difficult process to do for lawyers. To get you into a court, you won't have much representation. I've heard Bastion, I don't know how that guy sleeps at night, he threw out representation, somehow using the Human Rights Act, God knows. And his client was overcharging my friend £4,000 to £8,000 per year for 3 years. And they said, oh, we'll go to the tribunal, it'll be mediation. And they walked in and they found themselves, they found that the tribunal eventually ruled, yes, you have been overcharged, you're right, they've got to reduce the bill by £4,000. Then they got hit with a bill for £120,000, and then their flat got taken. And I'm not saying that not even the bill for £120,000 got taken, the entire flat got taken. That is forfeiture. You can basically, you breach the covenants, your property is mine. It doesn't matter if you owed me just the ground rent of £100. If you breach the ground rents, you can lose your flat, your property. So there's no security of tenure in this. And as a leaseholder, you pay for all the repairs and everything being done on your property. And you are always on the back foot. So we're finding now that councils, there's a leasehold act that was introduced. The councils have managed to, for that act to not be enacted, because they won't provide receipts. We're finding that the associations that you go to, which you think will protect you, like RICS, Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, we're finding that's just a jobs club for the industry as well. And they all kind of just close ranks in there. So we're finding that properties that have been forfeited have been sold onto other people, and the completion done in a day. That can't happen in any normal terms. It will take you normally 12 weeks to complete on a property. So there's something very odd going on here, which includes the land registry, includes the tribunals. Thank you, that's brilliant. And we can't get the data. We can't, you know, leaseholders are not only losing their flats, they're losing their minds. Noel, this lady whose flat, she tried to fight the battle, she used to work for KPMG. Her flat, basically the landlords, her freeholders, charged everybody to build a new flat on the top. And they couldn't forensically get to the bottom of this to show it. They knew it was happening, but to try and get that data in front of the people who would stop it was an impossible thing. So my plea is to you that I'm an activist, you know, I'm not a geeky person, but there is so much work to be done here to get the data that is available, to create apps, to get leaseholders to join up. People in flats are frightened to link up with others because they're frightened of forfeiture, they're frightened of being targeted. So there are many, many things to also maybe help on joining the hashtag leasehold scandal campaign, which is to ban leasehold, to turn it into common hold. Scotland's abolished it. You know, it's just England and Wales that has it. It's feudal. And I'll leave you with this last thing, that in the olden days, I mean, all this leasehold law goes back to 1066 and the Crusaders disappearing off. And in order for them to protect their property, they stuck it into leasehold so that their family could get their property. In those days, if you had been sentenced to death for whatever crime, you could choose to have your head chopped off to be hung, or you could choose another form of death, which was really painful. It was to lie down, have a wooden door laid on top of you, and people would put rocks on top of you until you suffocated to death. And what was the benefit in having this goddamn awful death? It meant that your property, you couldn't be disinherited from your property, and it wouldn't go back to the freeholder. Now, this is archaic stuff and where it comes from. And just as I said, my plea is to people to talk about it, to get it out there, because you've got the Duke of Westminster dying, 9 billion of his leasehold property being passed on to the next generation with no tax paid because it's all in offshore trusts. And my understanding is, if you go to the Frontline Club and you listen to Oliver Buller, that 50% of all global money is disappearing into offshore trusts. EU, UK are not actually in debt if you bring offshore trust money back. It's trillions over there. It's multinationals and high net worth individuals. High net worth individuals and multinationals are involved in this. Aviva, insurance companies, they're all involved in this nightmare that we're dealing with here. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.